Chapter 52. Looked attentively at me? Anything that I had seen in Miss Havisham? No. In some of her looks and gestures there was that tinge of resemblance to Miss Havisham which may often be noticed to have been acquired by children, from grown person with whom they have been much associated and secluded, and which, when childhood is past, will produce a remarkable occasional likeness of expression between faces that are otherwise quite different. And yet I could not trace this to Miss Havisham. I looked again, and though she was still looking at me, the suggestion was gone. What was it? I am serious, said Estella, not so much with a frown, for her brow was smooth, as with a darkening of her face. If we are to be thrown much together, you had better believe it at once. No, imperiously stopping me as I opened my lips. I have not bestowed my tenderness anywhere. I have never had any such thing. In another moment we were in the brewery so long disused, and she pointed to the high gallery, where I had seen her going out on that same first day, and told me she remembered to have been up there, and to have seen me standing scared below. As my eyes followed her white hand, again the same dim suggestion, that I could not possibly grasp, crossed me. My involuntary start occasioned her to lay her hand upon my arm. Instantly the ghost passed once more, and was gone. What was it? What is the matter? Asked Estella. Are you scared again? I should be, if I believed what you said just now, I replied, to turn it off. Then you don't? Very well. It is said, at any rate. Miss Havisham will soon be expecting you at your old post, though I think that might be laid aside now, with other old belongings. Let us make one more round of the garden, and then go in. Come. You shall not shed tears for my cruelty today. You shall be my page, and give me your shoulder. Her handsome dress had trailed upon the ground. She held it in one hand now, and with the other lightly touched my shoulder as we walked. We walked round the ruined garden twice or thrice more, and it was all in bloom for me. If the green and yellow growth of weed in the chinks of the old wall had been the most precious flowers that ever blew, it could not have been more cherished in my remembrance. There was no discrepancy of years between us, to remove her far from me. We were of nearly the same age, though of course the age told for more in her case than in mine. But the air of inaccessibility which her beauty and her manner gave her, tormented me in the midst of my delight, and at the height of the assurance I felt, that our patroness had chosen us for one another. Wretched boy! At last we went back into the house, and there I heard, with surprise, that my guardian had come down to see Miss Havisham on business, and would come back to dinner. The old wintry branches of chandeliers in the room, where the mouldering table was spread, had been lighted while we were out, and Miss Havisham was in her chair and waiting for me. It was like pushing the chair itself back into the past, when we began the old slow circuit round about the ashes of the bridal feast. But, in the funereal room, with that figure of the grave fallen back in the chair fixing its eyes upon her, Estella looked more bright and beautiful than before, and I was under stronger enchantment. The time so melted away that our early dinner hour drew close at hand, and Estella left us to prepare herself. We had stopped near the center of the long table, and Miss Havisham, with one of her withered arms stretched out of the chair, rested that clenched hand upon the yellow cloth. As Estella looked back over her shoulder, before going out at the door, Miss Havisham kissed that hand to her, with a ravenous intensity that was of its kind quite dreadful. Then, Estella being gone, and we two left alone, she turned to me, and said in a whisper, Is she beautiful, graceful, well-grown? Do you admire her? Everybody must who sees her, Miss Havisham. She drew an arm round my neck, and drew my head close down to hers as she sat in the chair. Love her, love her, love her. How does she use you? Before I could answer, if I could have answered so difficult a question at all, she repeated, Love her, love her, love her. If she favors you, love her. If she wounds you, love her. If she tears your heart to pieces, and as it gets older and stronger, it will tear deeper. Love her, love her, love her. Never had I seen such passionate eagerness as was joined to her utterance of these words. I could feel the muscles of the thin arm round my neck swell with the vehemence that possessed her. Hear me, Pip. I adopted her to be loved. I bred her and educated her to be loved. I developed her into what she is, that she might be loved. Love her. She said the word often enough, and there could be no doubt that she meant to say it. But if the often repeated word had been hate instead of love, despair, revenge, dire death, it could not have sounded from her lips more like a curse. I'll tell you, said she, in the same hurried, passionate whisper, what real love is. It is blind devotion, unquestioning self-humiliation, utter submission, trust and belief against yourself, and against the whole world, giving up your whole heart and soul to the smiter as I did. When she came to that, and to a wild cry that followed that, I caught her round the waist. For she rose up in the chair, in her shroud of a dress, and struck at the air, as if she would as soon have struck herself against the wall and fallen dead. All this passed in a few seconds. As I drew her down into her chair, I was conscious of a scent that I knew, and turning, saw my guardian in the room. He always carried, I have not yet mentioned it, I think, a pocket handkerchief of rich silk, and of imposing proportions, which was of great value to him in his profession. I have seen him so terrify a client, or a witness by ceremoniously unfolding this pocket handkerchief, as if he were immediately going to blow his nose, and then pausing, as if he knew he should not have time to do it before such client or witness committed himself, that the self-committal has followed directly, quite as a matter of course. When I saw him in the room, he had this expressive pocket handkerchief in both hands, and was looking at us. On meeting my eye, he said plainly, by a momentary and silent pause in that attitude, indeed, singular, and then put the handkerchief to its right use with wonderful effect. Miss Havisham had seen him, as soon as I, and was, like everybody else, afraid of him. She made a strong attempt to compose herself, and stammered that he was as punctual as ever. As punctual as ever, he repeated, coming up to us. How do you do, Pip? Shall I give you a ride, Miss Havisham? Once round? And so you are here, Pip? I told him when I had arrived, and how Miss Havisham had wished me to come and see Estella. To which he replied, ah, very fine young lady. Then he pushed Miss Havisham in her chair before him, with one of his large hands, and put the other in his trousers pocket, as if the pocket were full of secrets. Well, Pip, how often have you seen Miss Estella before? Said he, when he came to a stop. How often? Ah, how many times? 10,000 times? Oh, certainly not so many. Twice? Jaggers, interposed Miss Havisham, much to my relief, leave my Pip alone, and go with him to your dinner. He complied, and we groped our way down the dark stairs together. While we were still on our way to those detached apartments across the paved yard at the back, he asked me how often I had seen Miss Havisham eat and drink, offering me a breadth of choice, as usual, between 100 times and once. I considered, and said, never. And never will, Pip, he retorted, with a frowning smile. She has never allowed herself to be seen doing either, since she lived this present life of hers. She wanders about in the night, and then lays hands on such food as she takes. Pray, sir, said I, may I ask you a question? You may, said he, and I may decline to answer it. Put your question. Estella's name. Is it Havisham or I had nothing to add? Or what? Said he. Is it Havisham? It is Havisham. This brought us to the dinner table, where she and Sarah Pocket awaited us. Mr. Jaggers presided, Estella sat opposite to him, I faced my green and yellow friend. We dined very well, and were waited on by a maid, servant whom I had never seen in all my comings and goings, but who, for anything I know, had been in, that mysterious house the whole time. After dinner, a bottle of choice old port was placed before my guardian. He was evidently well acquainted with the vintage, and the two ladies left us. Anything to equal the determined reticence of Mr. Jaggers under that roof, I never saw elsewhere, even in him. He kept his very looks to himself, and scarcely directed his eyes to Estella's face once during dinner. When she spoke to him, he listened, and in due course answered, but never looked at her, that I could see. On the other hand, she often looked at him, with interest and curiosity, if not distrust, but his face never showed the least consciousness. Throughout dinner he took a dry delight in making Sarah Pocket greener and yellower, by often referring in conversation with me to my expectations. But here, again, he showed no consciousness, and even made it appear that he extorted, and even did extort, though I don't know how those references out of my innocent self. And when he and I were left alone together, he sat with an air upon him of general lying by in consequence of information he possessed, that really was too much for me. He cross-examined his very wine, when he had nothing else in hand. He held it between himself and the candle, tasted the port, rolled it in his mouth, swallowed it, looked at his glass again, smelt the port, tried it, drank it, filled again, and cross-examined the glass again, until I was as nervous as if I had known the wine, to be telling him something to my disadvantage. Three or four times I feebly thought I would start conversation, but whenever he saw me going to ask him anything, he looked at me with his glass in his hand, and rolling his wine about in his mouth, as if requesting me to take notice that it was of no use, for he couldn't answer. I think Miss Pocket was conscious that the sight of me involved her in the danger of being goaded to madness, and perhaps tearing off her cap, which was a very hideous one, in the nature of a muslin mop, and strewing the ground with her hair, which assuredly had never grown on her head. She did not appear when we afterwards went up to Miss Havisham's room, and we four played at whist. In the interval, Miss Havisham, in a fantastic way, had put some of the most beautiful jewels from her dressing table into Estella's hair, and about her bosom and arms, and I saw even my guardian look at her from under his thick eyebrows, and raise them a little, when her loveliness was before him, with those rich flushes of glitter and color in it. Of the manner and extent to which he took our trumps into custody, and came out with mean little cards at the ends of hands, before which the glory of our kings and queens was utterly abased, I say nothing, nor of the feeling that I had, respecting his looking upon us personally in the light of three very obvious and poor riddles that he had found out long ago. What I suffered from was the incompatibility between his cold presence and my feelings towards Estella. It was not that I knew I could never bear to speak to him about her, that I knew I could never bear to hear him creak his boots at her, that I knew I could never bear to see him wash his hands of her. It was that my admiration should be within a foot or two of him. It was that my feelings should be in the same place with him. That was the agonizing circumstance. We played until 9 o'clock, and then it was arranged that when Estella came to London I should be forewarned of her coming, and should meet her at the coach, and then I took leave of her, and touched her and left her. My guardian lay at the door in the next room to mine. Far into the night, Miss Havisham's words, "Love her, love her, love her," sounded in my ears. I adapted them for my own repetition, and said to my pillow, "I love her, I love her, I love her," hundreds of times. Then, a burst of gratitude came upon me, that she should be destined for me, once the blacksmith's boy. Then, I thought if she were, as I feared, by no means rapturously grateful for that destiny yet, when would she begin to be interested in me? When should I awaken the heart within her, that was mute and sleeping now? Ah me! I thought those were high and great emotions. But I never thought there was anything low and small in my keeping away from Joe, because I knew she would be contemptuous of him. It was but a day gone, and Joe had brought the tears into my eyes. They had soon dried, God forgive me! Soon dried. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.